Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So, whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with some of the stories that really count. Coming up on the program today, South Africa's cost of living spirals as a new report tracks a 12-year squeeze. Gambling ads in Home Affairs offices sparks outrage and a political backlash. After the Biden diagnosis, we learn that prostate cancer is the top killer of South African men. And the streaming revolution shaping television is boosting brand power and influence. It's Tuesday, the 20th of May. Now, the cost of living in South Africa is rising faster than wages, with the working and poor and vulnerable households obviously taking the hardest hit. And this is very disturbing. Now, there's a new report from the National Planning Commission, along with UNICEF, and it tracks more than a decade of data and is now offering urgent solutions and recommendations. And in that respect, I'm joined now by NPC Commissioner Makhiba Molo to discuss the findings and what they mean for the country's broader developmental agenda. Makhiba, the single most concerning trend that the report uncovered, what's your assessment here?
Oh, thank you, Jeremy. I think what's clear is the incredible increase in the cost of food over the period that we've looked at. I mean, it has increased by 95%. And I think that we don't really need data to tell us that. I think it's a lived experience for all South Africans that has clearly impacted everybody, but particularly the poor and particularly those who are dependent on social grants.
And it raises questions, I guess, about whether the social grant framework is enough to shield the most vulnerable and, more broadly, whether wage policies are keeping pace with the rising cost of basic services and food as well.
So I think what's clear from the evidence is that wages are certainly not at all keeping up with the cost of living. I mean, I think across all sectors, wages, unfortunately, are failing to keep up. And of course, inflation has also wreaked havoc. So by no stretch of the imagination are wages able to keep up with inflation or the costs of anything in any sector, really. But when it comes to grants, more specifically to your question, I think it's quite a difficult one. There has been an increase in grants over the last year. We've seen that the child grant increased a little bit. So did the foster care grant, the disability grant, I suppose grants across the board, really, the SRD by 20 Rand. And the question is, can those grants really keep up with the cost of basic goods? That's clearly not the case. I think there has to be more of a concerted effort to be able to create possibilities for people to be able to derive an income and not have to rely on social grants. But unfortunately, the way things are currently, people have to, unfortunately, rely on social grants.
Are you able to give us a sense of tangibly how this cost of living is impacting poor and working class households, and maybe where you could look at it from where compromises are being made and where people are just being forced to deny themselves?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a number of trade-offs. People generally have to choose between buying food for their children or buying clothes, paying for energy, for example. And we know that the energy supply hasn't been particularly reliable in any event. So people have to look for alternative sources of energy. And these are all trade-offs that people have to make in the household. When we launched the report on Friday, we also had a conversation about the fact that women particularly are inclined to skip a meal because they need to be able to ensure that the children have eaten. And another question is, how nutritious is the food that they're eating anyway. So there have been many compromises in terms of the quality of food, the consistency of food, the availability of food. And then, of course, this idea of women particularly skipping out on meals. The cost of education, of course. How are people supposed to access even basic education? Because in order for them to get to schools, for example, they have to pay for transport. So there are these kinds of trade-offs where mothers are not necessarily able to send their children to school because they can't afford the transport cost, even if education itself is free. But then what happens to the children during the day when the parents have to go to school, etc.? Unfortunately, it's a cyclical effect.
Is the problem more pronounced in urban or rural areas, or an even spread, do you think?
It certainly looks like, based on the data, it certainly looks like it's an even spread. But of course, you have a lot more rural people migrating to the urban areas, as we've seen over time, for different reasons. A lot of them are looking for better basic services, so better access to services. And then some are looking for economic opportunities. So we have seen that a lot of people are migrating from the rural areas, obviously also because there are fewer economic opportunities in the rural areas. And we're starting to see that some provinces are starting to have more unemployed people, unfortunately, or more working poor. So even where people are working, they are now categorized as the working poor because the cost of living is impacting everybody. But even in the more wealthier classes, even in the middle classes, we're starting to see a narrowing of that inequality gap. And that narrowing is not as a result of people becoming wealthier. It's actually as a result of people becoming poorer.
And I suppose it would be difficult to put your finger on any immediate policy shifts that you could recommend to bring relief to low-income households. Turning something this of this size around is not an easy job, and nor is it one that's going to happen quickly.
Yeah, I guess the policymakers are really tasked with having to pay particular attention to the findings of the report and the gaps and what needs to be done in the immediate term to try and relieve these factors. We know that there's the budget, third time round. Hopefully we'll be lucky this time and it will actually get passed. But yeah, these are the kinds of considerations, unfortunately, that the policymakers really have to pay attention to. What are the more immediate solutions? Yeah, I guess that is the question of the day. And I think the policymakers really do have to look at what they're going to be putting into the budget, where they can cut costs that are unnecessary so that they can redirect expenditure towards social security. I mean, I think those are critical conversations that they have to have. Things obviously about providing job opportunities, those can't happen overnight, but I mean, those need to be accelerated. I think that EPW programs, community work programs, those have to be paid particular attention to and definitely have to be accelerated. But yeah, I think that in the short term, we have to look at what's going to happen with the budget and how much more can be channeled towards social security. I don't know that there is much room, but there really does have to be a solution.
And somewhere. I guess to a slightly longer lens, maybe a rethink as well on the priorities in the next medium-term strategic framework.
The priorities, I think, have been outlined. I think the problem is always around implementation. And I think that we as NPC3 have certainly been calling for greater focus on implementation. I think that the targets are there. And I think that there are pathways, absolutely, to solutions, pathways to meeting some of these targets. Again, it's all about implementation. It's about a commitment, of course, political will, and absolutely has to be underscored by acceleration. I think that maybe we do have an opportunity now with everything that's happening in the world, with certain programs having been unfortunately denied aid, it does give us an opportunity to look at more creative ways, more collaborative ways of trying to address some of these concerns. But yeah, I think it means that we all have to really come together and address with a greater sense of urgency, a greater sense of pragmatism, these problems, because they are certainly affecting all of us. I mean, as I say, I mean, even the middle classes are affected. And I think if ever there was a time for all of us to come together as the playing field is being leveled, it is now.
Thank you very much indeed for talking to me. That's National Planning Commission Commissioner Makhiba Molo. I do appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, it's reported that South Africans are spending something in the region of R1 trillion a year on gambling. That is an enormous amount of money. It's around 15% of GDP. It's going into lotteries, casinos and online betting, with very little coming back in the form of tax. Now, the political party Rise Mzansi's National Assembly Whip, Makashule Ghana, is calling this a national crisis, one that is hitting the poorest hardest. And he's calling for urgent reform, starting with a meeting with the National Gambling Board. But what exactly does Rise Mzansi want to change, and what is the process going forward as far as it's concerned? Makashule Ghana, a very warm welcome to you. First of all, that figure of 1 trillion rand, how do you arrive at that figure?
So how the National Gambling Board, and greetings to you, Jeremy, how they arrive at that figure, it's, let's say, for instance, someone bets or plays a bet for 100 rands and then they win 200 rands. When they place the second bet of 300 rands, they will then classify the 400 rand that has been bet as the amount of money that has been wagered, not only the 100 rand that has been was the original amount. So the figure of 1 trillion, it's a cumulative that includes the winnings that are then placed as bets again. That's how you then get to the figure. So the figures are very high by any stretch. You know, I was looking at the results of one of the betting companies yesterday. I think they grew their quarter on quarter revenue by 125%. So we have in this country that the fastest growing industry, it's the gambling and sports betting industry.
And in fact, your party has now described this as a runaway gambling crisis, if I've read your statements correctly. What exactly is pushing you to act right now?
So it's one, the dangers around gambling addiction. Two, just proliferation of gambling adverts. We have a situation where advertising for gambling and sports betting, it's happening 24 hours on radio, on TV, on social media. And the first thing that we want to see happen, this does not require a change in legislation, is that there needs to be reforms in the gambling and sports betting advertising landscape. In the same way that you do have, for instance, as you know, Jeremy, that the alcohol companies are not allowed to advertise 24 hours a day. There are set times that they are allowed to advertise and certain times that they are not allowed to advertise. This is so that you are able to protect minors, protect the most vulnerable in society. And that's what we are pushing for right now. So that is the first thing that we believe that we can get. It's a low-hanging fruit to then deal with the industry. And once that is done, we'll then move into the tax rates that these gambling companies are paying, because the amount of people, and I continue having a conversation with the Responsible Gambling Foundation, the number of calls that they are now fielding, it's escalating at an alarming rate. All right. These are people that are seeking assistance for their addiction.
Whichever way you look at it, the amount of money is huge. But can you clarify for me how much of that actually comes from poorer South Africans? How do we know that? Because that is the claim that you're making in terms of your concern.
There's a lot that is coming from poorer South Africans. Actually, when one studied, and I've been studying, following up this industry, You will see that from the time that there was a payment of the SRD grant and how the industry boomed, if you were to follow the trend from that moment, you'll then see that a large portion or you can make a conclusion that a large portion of that of the money that was paid through the SRD grant ended up going into betting and gambling. The reason I started raising this issue, Jeremy, it was an observation. So I had seen on the day that the SRD grant was paid, so there was a long queue outside the post office, and I was in Soweto. There was a long queue outside the post office. Equally, there was a long queue outside a betting outlet. It was the same profile of people. On the same day, it was a midweek, so it was not like weekend where you'll say the Premier League or the PSL are playing. It was during the day, midweek. So one could see that, no, there's a long queue at post office, and then there's a long queue outside a betting
outlet. All right, let me ask you this question.
Prompted me to start asking the question.
Fair enough.
Yes.
Now, my understanding is the National Gambling Board has a mandate to monitor socioeconomic gambling patterns, and they've had this mandate for a number of years. Are you suggesting that the NGB is now failing in its responsibility to protect vulnerable South Africans?
They have been failing, Jeremy. Actually, there hasn't been a board. So we have a national gambling board that does not have a board. It only has got an administrator. The national gambling board has not had a board for the last 10 years. The last time there was a board was around 2013, 2014. The National Gambling Policy Council, this is where provinces, the provincial gambling boards, the national gambling board, the Minister of Trade and Industry, come together to then look at the gambling and betting landscape, has not met since 2018. So for the last 7 years, they haven't met. The National Gambling Board has not had a functional board for the last 10 years. So the National Gambling Board has been failing. The National Gambling Policy Council has been failing. That's why you see all these betting companies doing as they wish. Now we even have an issue, and I'm happy that the Home Affairs, through the pressure that we are applying in Parliament, has cancelled the deal that had Betway advertising at Home Affairs offices and saying, no, we're providing free Wi-Fi. But to be able to access the free Wi-Fi, you have to go through the Betway channel, which means now you are subjected to all these Betway adverts before you access the free Wi-Fi. They say they've cancelled that deal. We have asked questions and want to see, how come you have a betting company advertising at the Home Affairs office? Because that can't be right.
All right,
that can't be right.
I'm going to leave it there, and thank you very much for raising that issue. That is Makhoshule Gana, who is the Rise Mzansi's National Assembly Whip. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, two of the world's most recognizable figures, former U.S. President Joe Biden and King Charles, have both faced recent cancer diagnosis, putting men's health back in the global spotlight. Here at home, the picture is no less urgent. Prostate cancer is the most common cancer affecting South African men, 1 in 15 likely to be diagnosed in their lifetime. And for black South African men, the risk is even higher and often more aggressive. Yet too few men are getting screened early or seeking treatment in time. I want to focus on this with Andrew Oberholzer, who's Chief Executive Officer of the Prostate Cancer Foundation of South Africa. Andrew, a very warm welcome, and I think fair to say the world took notice when both King Charles and President Biden revealed their cancer diagnoses. How do these high-profile cases, in your opinion, either help or hinder awareness, particularly around prostate cancer?
Thanks, Jeremy, and good morning to all the listeners. I think anything that draws attention to prostate cancer is beneficial. The more awareness we have, the more men are likely to realize that screening is so important, because if we catch this cancer in the early stages, it is curable. The problem is, as in Joe Biden's case, once this cancer has advanced, generally spreads to bone first, there's no cure for the cancer at that point. We can only slow progression of the disease. So really our focus needs to be on screening. And unfortunately, there's no symptoms in the early stages of prostate cancer, which is again why screening is so important.
Andrew, in South Africa, I think that figure I quoted, 1 in 15, is disturbing at risk of prostate cancer. Why is this particular cancer so prevalent in this country?
So that figure is actually very low. We talk about 1 in 8 white males getting prostate cancer and about 1 in 4 black guys. So the risk for black guys is about 60% higher. And there's a genetic component definitely involved in there. We haven't been able to identify those exact genes at this point. But black guys tend to get a prostate cancer at a younger age and a more aggressive type. And they have a more aggressive prostate cancer even than black American men. So we have a massive challenge in South Africa. And in fact, prostate cancer, we are one of the countries with the highest rates of men dying from prostate cancer in the world. So we really have a lot of work to do here.
What are the most common symptoms then that men should be aware of, particularly as you've just said, there are no early warning signs?
So that's why we want them to go for screening. And screening is a simple blood test called a PSA blood test. If they're not having symptoms, they don't have to have the dreaded DRE or digital rectal examination. Just the blood test gives us an idea if something's wrong in the prostate. If they are experiencing symptoms, they're often urinary symptoms, as was the case with Joe Biden, but those can overlap with symptoms of an enlarged prostate and men struggling to urinate, stopping and starting, suddenly having an urgent need to urinate. But once it starts to spread to the bones, men will often come in with lower back pain, pain in the pelvic area. Sometimes the urethra gets completely obstructed and men can't urinate at all. So those are warning signs of early prostate cancer. Men must then go and get checked as soon as possible.
And how early should men start getting screened, and how often then should they do so?
So we recommend all black guys and anybody with a history of prostate or breast cancer in a first degree relative consider screening from about the age of 40. And then for all other males from about 45. Also men who have a BRCA2 gene, that's the gene that's really involved in a lot of breast cancers. If you know your mother's had breast cancer and it was BRCA2 positive, they should also screen from the age of 40. So that family history and those hereditary factors do put men more at risk. And it's important to know your family history when it comes to prostate cancer.
Is there still either a stigma or a reluctance among men to get screened? And if that's the case, how do you change that paradigm?
I think a lot of the fear was around the digital rectal, the finger, which the doctor puts up the rectum to feel the prostate. But as I've said, we don't require that for men who are not experiencing symptoms anymore. So that's a big relax for men. And then it's just men are not as good as going for annual health checks. And we recommend you include that PSA screening test in your annual health check when you're going for your cardiometabolic risk assessment to check for any cardiovascular problems. You have your cholesterol check, you have your blood pressure check, your waist circumference measure. Just include that in with that. And unfortunately, men tend to not be proactive about their health. They tend to wait for symptoms. So we want men to be a little bit more proactive and take ownership of their health, and then just do that check every year once you're in the habit of going.
And Andrew, in that respect, is PSA testing widely accessible, particularly in public healthcare facilities, or is cost and maybe even access still a major barrier here?
So quite correct, Jeremy. Access is a problem. We are trying to work with Department of Health, and they reassure us that any man who goes to their local clinic and requests a PSA blood test, provided they're in those age groups, will be given one. If they're not, then men should get hold of us at the Prostate Cancer Foundation, and we will follow up with that. So it's first of all a lack of knowledge of the importance of going for that test, but there is an accessibility problem, unfortunately, in our public sector, as with so many health issues.
And just a quick one in conclusion, obviously treatment options are available. How would men know which treatment path is the right one for them?
That's something that they need to do a little bit of homework on, because every one of those treatments have side effects. In the early stages, it's either surgery or radiation with brachy or external beam radiation. If it's at an advanced stage, then we have to take testosterone away. So that's the case with Joe Biden, where they're looking at hormonal therapy, or what we call androgen deprivation therapy, where we remove testosterone from the body. But unfortunately, that comes with some major side effects and it impacts quality of life hugely. So that's why catching it in the early stage is so important. And 98% of guys, if we catch it in the early stages, will be alive after 5 years. Only 30% of guys will be alive if we catch them when the cancer has already spread or metastasized. So that early detection is the key message today.
Andrew Oberholzer, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer, the Prostate Cancer Foundation of South Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now let's move on to media, and television advertising isn't dead. It's just becoming a whole lot smarter. As streaming habits surge and smart TVs become the new battleground for attention, advertisers are starting to learn how to rethink everything. It's no longer just about the 7 p.m. or the 8 p.m. slot. Today's most valuable real estate is the first screen you see when you turn on your smart TV, and enter something called connected TV, where digital precision is meeting big screen presence. I want to flesh this out a little bit with Leslie Adams. He's been on the program before, sales director at Reach Africa, to discuss why CTV might just be the future of brand building. Always good to talk to you, Leslie. Now, you say the first screen is the most valuable. What makes that moment more powerful than a primetime ad break, for instance?
I think prime time, as we understood it, in appointment viewing, is really a thing of the past, where people can now tune into the content they love at their own convenience, no longer at just 7 p.m. And why the opening screen, the landing screen of a television becomes so important is that in the previous time, in terms of turning on the television and your content simply being on, now you have to go and find that content, select the platform it's on, and then choose the content. The landing page is before all of that, and suddenly your brand can cut through the noise by preempting it and being there as you turn on your television.
All very exciting, but do you think that so-called connected TV is still out of the reach for many South Africans, or is your data telling you a different story?
I think data has been quite an interesting one. We've watched the growth of satellite and pay television and free satellite grow at what looks like it to be quite fast, but now when we compare it to the likes of how connectivity is growing, it's actually quite slow. We already have over 9.5 million homes with access to high-speed fiber. The launch of fiber within the township areas has exploded with air fiber and new innovations in terms of applications there. Now, suddenly, everybody with a cell phone can stream content, and now the growth of television access and high-speed content access is becoming more universal and more widely spread. So suddenly, this connected TV space will actually outpace and overtake what we now know as traditional satellite TV. So it's quite interesting to see what the data is telling us and what the trends are pointing to.
And in that respect, then, do you think that brands are adapting fast enough to the screen-first moment, which is, as you're suggesting, going to become more and more prevalent?
The screen-first moment is a really challenging one for brands because so much happens on a screen. So it's not just entertainment and television. It's also music. It's also search. It's also so many things in terms of social. And what we find is that the engagement levels across different spaces and different engagement points is slightly altered for each consumer. So even if you're watching your favorite TV content, you could be commuting or laying back at home. And those two different mind spaces means brands use those times very differently. Are we adapting as quickly as we'd like to? I think the challenge for every brand and marketer out there is that we need to move at the speed of culture. And the speed of culture, unfortunately, means you have to almost chase this consumer down, but also meet them organically in the different mind spaces and the screens that they consume. That's a very difficult answer to say yes or no, but I think the challenge is that it's said that the consumers are moving into this sort of screen-first world or content-first world, and how we can communicate with them in those different environments.
So just a quick follow-up there. Given the current economic constraints that South Africa is experiencing right now, are you seeing or do you think we will see more local brands buying into CTV? Or for the short term, at least, is it going to remain the domain of global players?
It's absolutely going to be a blended domain. Local brands will participate. Local brands are already participating in many ways, whether it's content creation or content ad buys. Because of the fact that, you know, 1 in 3 TVs sold in South Africa are now connected to the internet means that it's a space where consumption is happening already. 1/3 of all viewing happens in a streaming environment, which means that brands have no choice but to participate in the space. How quickly this will grow and accelerate, I think, is going to be another thing to watch as well, because it's not that TV is changing or declining. It's the evolution of how TV is being consumed is evolving.
Do you think there is a risk of the CTV moments, as you've just explained to me, becoming a little over-commercialized? Remember those early days of banner ads, for instance?
So I think this is the balance that I think CTV will have to learn and really sort of pay close attention to. Because I think we can learn from the mistakes around broadcast and traditional ad blockings. There's a way to learn from how YouTube has served ads in a sort of social video environment. And there's a way to be innovative and creative and deliver more contextual, more relevant, and more impactful ads within the spaces without annoying the consumer. I think the absolute reality is that if we look at the international global players, even Netflix has now adopted ads, Disney has adopted ads, because the business model requires them to have an additional line of revenue outside of subscription. What it also means is that we have to create an environment that is ad-friendly, but consumer-friendly equally as well. I think the balance between those two is a really interesting space for innovation and for brands to communicate in a way that consumers will want to receive that message.
And picking up on that consumer-friendly line, QR codes are often built into the ad experience. So we're reaching a point, surely, where we are now really bridging that gap between television and e-commerce. It's been a long time coming.
Absolutely has. And I think e-commerce has really unlocked different spaces, making every screen, every digital ad, a moment to convert. But I think in a really interesting, in a really sort of simplistic marketing way, brands advertise to bring solutions to consumers through their products. And ultimately, if you can do that in a way that's relevant through targeting, that is timely through where you target them and what context you target them, the QR code simply allows for them to easier access that solution quickly as possible.
Providing there's a demonstrable return on investment and that brands can see the needle moving.
No, absolutely. I think everything when it comes to brand is about ROI. But I think from a consumer perspective, it's about, you know, if you've delivered the solution to the right person and they're keen to act at that moment, which, by the way, marketing, this balance between wanting to buy now or buy later is a constant tug of war. But the fact of the matter is, if you do find someone willing to buy now, give them an opportunity and a shop window and an access point to do so.
Leslie Adams, always good talking to you, Sales Director at Reach Africa. I do appreciate your time. And that is MoneyWeb at Midday for today. We are live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.